Here's a question specifically for our American listeners. When do you feel most patriotic? Think about it. Perhaps when you see Old Glory painting the breeze, or maybe when you say the Pledge of Allegiance, or perhaps when you find yourself singing or humming along to our national anthem. That's when I feel most patriotic, and I do not just because of the words I'm singing, but because where I'm typically singing them. Because when I sing the national anthem, I'm typically watching a baseball game. And that is what our show is about today. Baseball is our most constitutional sport. It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about baseball and specifically about a book called The Babe Ruth Deception.
Welcome to your Weekly Constitutional, hosted by Professor Stuart Harris and produced in partnership with the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier.
Baseball is different from any other sport in a lot of different little ways.
Well, George Carlin was certainly right about that. Baseball is special, and it's special in a constitutional sense. In fact, it's the only sport that is played for money and yet is exempt from our antitrust laws in a very constitutional series of cases that we'll talk about a little bit later. But I get ahead of myself. The particular reason we're talking about baseball today is because a good friend of mine by the name of David O. Stewart recently wrote a book about baseball. It's a novel, historical novel. It's called The Babe Ruth Deception. And very shortly, we'll be speaking to David about that book. But when I mentioned that to Wayne Winkler, my executive producer, he expressed a bit of skepticism. He said, what does baseball have to do with the Constitution? And then we had a lengthy discussion about that, after which, well, I'm not going to spoil the ending here, and I'll just share a little bit of our analysis that we went through. And in fact, later on, Wayne and I will be talking about baseball's special constitutional status. But in the meantime, let me reintroduce David Stewart. And I say reintroduce because he's been on the show three previous times. Several years ago, I interviewed him about his book, American Emperor, which was all about Aaron Burr and his adventures in the American West. I interviewed him later, his book on James Madison called Madison's Gift, which was all about Madison's ability to work with others, to form alliances, and to accomplish great things. And then most recently, I interviewed David about one of his earlier novels called The Wilson Deception. Now, that one was an easy call because it was all about President Wilson and the Treaty of Versailles and all of the constitutional and political issues that surrounded that. David always gives good interviews, and I think you'll agree that this one is among his best.
I'm David Stewart. I write historical narratives and historical fiction. Principally, so far, it's been historical mysteries.
Well, you used to write historical narratives, but you have crossed over to the dark side and become a full-time fiction writer, haven't you?
Well, I'm doing a lot of fiction, but I have not burned the bridge. I'm still thinking a little about a project that would be straight history again. So, I like to mix it up.
Indeed you do, because I've noted before that though your first couple of historical novels were very politically oriented, the current one we're about to talk about has not that much to do with American political history, does it?
No, it was a great relief, actually. It's The Babe Ruth Deception. It focuses on the Babe's first 2 years with the New York Yankees, 1920 and 21, when he really just revolutionized baseball, made it a power game. It's also the first years of Prohibition, and it's just a great tumultuous time in New York. It was a lot of fun to work on.
Well, just so that everybody's clear, even though you are an old codger, this is still a bit before your time, isn't it?
Yes. I can't have any first-hand experience of any of this.
Well, okay, good. Well, I'm just thinking ahead now. If you keep moving forward at 10 or 20-year intervals, you'll eventually tap into your own lifespan. And then you may eventually actually be able to write about something you have personal knowledge of.
I've always shied away from that, obviously. But you don't want to know too much.
I suppose not. Well, it was a fascinating read. It really was. I cannot claim to be a baseball fan in the sense of being able to memorize statistics or, quite frankly, even following the game that closely from a year-to-year basis. But I have a great love of the game, primarily as a bit of Americana. As a part of the American identity. And I think you have picked an era where that happened, where it really did become the national pastime.
Well, it's a great moment, and I appreciate your focusing on that, because the Black Sox scandal breaks in 1920. This is whether the previous year's World Series in 1919 had been rigged at the behest of evil gamblers, and whether the players had been bribed to throw it, the players on the White Sox, who were the ever after called the Black Sox. So there really was a risk to the game and its tradition, whether it would survive as a centerpiece of American life. And, you know, it was Babe Ruth who saved it. And it ultimately, I think, is the 1921 series where he does, even though he loses the series. And it's just a wonderful moment when a lot was sort of hanging in the balance for baseball and, of course, for my characters in the story and for the Babe.
You know, as much as it pains me to ask you to do this, I've noticed lately that when I make historical or pop culture references in my constitutional law classes, that the students look at me blankly. And I've suddenly realized...
No more references to the Carpenters.
No. It's just terrible. And most of them, I've suddenly realized, are younger than my own children.
Yeah.
And that is really a revelation. But just for that crowd, whom we hope is listening to this broadcast, who exactly was Babe Ruth? Where did he come from? What did he do?
Well, he came from nothing. He came from an extremely tough neighborhood in Baltimore. It's a sad childhood. His family was torn up. He was sent to live in an orphanage from the age of about 7 or 8. Even though his parents were still around, they were pretty non-functional. And he lived there until he signed a baseball contract at about age 16. You know, that's a pretty hard way to grow up, but he was a spectacular athlete.
Before we leave the orphanage, I seem to recall from having read one of those inspirational biographies for young children years ago at our local public library, it was a Catholic place, wasn't it? And there was a particular priest, Father somebody or other, who
yes,
was a real baseball fan and sort of took him under his wing, right?
Yes, it was St. Mary's Industrial School, which is no longer around. Mm-hmm. And Brother Matthias was this giant of a man who could hit the ball a long way. And he became sort of the mentor and overseer for Babe, who was then, I think, just called George. Mm-hmm. And Babe had this remarkable talent, and people noticed right off.
He's known as a hitter. If people have heard of him, they've heard of him as a hitter. But he was also a wonderful pitcher, wasn't he?
You know, there's always these arguments about who was the greatest ever. Mm-hmm. And with Ruth, you know, he played before steroids and all the good stuff that helped some of the more modern players. But no one has been an all-star pitcher and an all-star hitter except Babe Ruth.
Wow.
You know, he set records, which have only recently, well, relatively recently been shattered as a pitcher. Although he gave up full-time pitching after about 5 years because he was such a good hitter.
There's another contradiction here, and I don't think people fully appreciate that. Pitchers are traditionally really bad hitters. In fact, isn't that the reason the American League has a so-called designated hitter rule?
Yes, absolutely. And, you know, Ruth was the obvious exception to that. And there have been a few exceptions over the years. He just loved to hit. And so as he got better at it, he also felt like it was less stress, less strain, you know, frankly, going out to the outfield.
Yes.
Yeah. It's not a bad place to spend an afternoon.
No, in fact, they put him in right field, didn't they?
Yeah.
Yeah, which is probably traditionally, since most batters are right-handed, they're going to hit the center and left. And so right field is kind of a place to stick a guy who just wants to stand around and take a good rest between at bats.
Yeah, although, you know, we all have this sort of visual image from old movies of Babe Ruth as this sort of pot-bellied, pigeon-toed guy who just had this quirky ability to hit the ball, but really was this physical disaster. And it's completely wrong. He was a physical marvel. He, you know, when you see pictures, there is even a movie of him at age 24. He was an beast. He was a tremendous physical specimen. And, you know, that's not all that surprising since he could play baseball so well.
Yeah, it is remarkable. Okay, so now we know who he was. So at the age of 16, he signs a contract, he gets drafted. And where does he go?
He played in the minors for a short time. He was with the Baltimore Orioles team, and then a little while with a team in Rhode Island, but then ends up with the Boston Red Sox, who had his contract, and he's with them for about 5 years, principally as a pitcher, and they win 3 World Series while he's there. He is not the lead star there. They have a great team. He's a very impressive pitcher, and he wins 18, 20 games a season, but they have a very deep team, and he's a young guy. And his last year there, he starts playing a lot of outfield, and he wants to, and he starts being very difficult to manage, and that wasn't an accident. He wanted to get away from the Red Sox and start over as an outfielder, and finally, between the 1919 and 1920 season, they sold his contract to the Yanks, and that's what Boston fans have cursed for years as the curse of the Bambino, that they never should have let the Babe go, because he went on to hit another 680 home runs.
Good heavens. Now, before we leave that, you mentioned Bambino, Spanish for baby. Where did the term Babe come from?
You know, it's far from crystal clear. When he first starts playing professional baseball, he's a very young guy. You know, he's a teenager. He's 16. And it seems that his manager with the Baltimore Orioles basically called him Babe on the theory that he was just a babe. And it stuck. He had a big moon face. He was very innocent, relatively innocent. There's wonderful stories. You know, when he first was traveling with the minor league team, you know, he'd go to a hotel and he'd ride the elevator all day because he just thought it was great. You know, it was just fun. And, you know, he was sort of a rube. So Babe fit, it stuck. Babe Ruth is a great name.
It is.
You know, it's way better than, you know, Heinie Schickelgruber or any of the other long names.
Okay, so now we know who Babe Ruth was, or at least we know the early Babe Ruth. You've already hinted that he went on with the New York Yankees and then became such a draw for the game. Didn't they refer to for Yankee Stadium? It was the house that Ruth built, right?
Yeah, the Yankee Stadium. The time my book covers, the Yankees didn't have their own field. They played in the New York Giants Stadium, which was the Polo Grounds. Mm-hmm. So at that time, they were planning to build what became Yankee Stadium. It's been replaced a few years back, but also by a new Yankee Stadium. But it was always called the house that Ruth built because he brought in so many fans that they had enough money to build the thing.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and this week it's all about baseball, that most constitutional of sports.
Well, let's see now. We have on our team, we have who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
That's what I want to find out, the guy's name. That's what I want to find out, the guy's name.
I'm telling you, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
Now, Abby, you want to be the manager of the baseball team?
Yes.
You know the guy's names?
Well, I should.
Well, now you tell me the guy's names on a baseball team.
I say, who's on first, what's on second, I don't know who's on third.
You ain't saying nothing to me yet. Go ahead and tell me.
I'm telling him.
You ain't said nothing yet. Go ahead and tell me.
Who's on first? What's on second? I don't know is on third.
You know the guy's name's on the baseball team?
Yes.
Well, go ahead. Who's on first?
Yes.
I mean the guy's name.
Who?
The guy playing first.
Who?
The guy playing first base.
Who?
The guy on first base.
Who is on first?
What are you asking me for? I don't know.
So we'll get to that constitutional stuff later. In the meantime, we're talking to author David O. Stewart about his book on baseball, The Babe Ruth Deception. After the break, we'll have our constitutional quiz, and then we'll come back and talk some more about baseball. Stick around. Well, I'm here in the studio with Mark. Mark, how are you? Mark is our technician, and he does a fantastic job on our quizzes, and he makes it all worthwhile because, you know, otherwise I'd be stuck in a little room with Doug, the quiz guy, and all by ourselves, and it's a frightening concept.
I like to cuddle.
You're a cuddly guy. You are a very cuddly guy. Do you have some quizzes for us today?
I do have a quiz today.
You have a quiz today, and do we have a contestant today?
Yes, hello. My name is Anthony. I am from Kensington, Maryland.
I don't think we broadcast in Kensington, Maryland yet. So do you listen to us online?
I actually listen to you on my phone via the podcast.
Oh, okay. Via the podcast. Absolutely tremendous. And what do you do, Anthony?
I teach AP U.S. Government and Politics at Albert Einstein High School in Kensington.
AP Government and Politics. Do you find use for the podcast in your class?
I do. I direct my students to it frequently and point out when you bring up issues that we're talking about in class.
Oh, I'm so gratified to hear that. There are a number of government classes, AP classes, a lot of those around the nation that use them. I hear from teachers like you periodically, and sometimes when I have the opportunity, I actually go and speak to their classes. So the next time I'm down in Kensington, if you want to, we can get together and we can do a shtick in your class. How about that?
That would be wonderful. You guys do a tremendous job.
Well, thanks very much, Anthony. Doug? Anthony is a highly qualified U.S. government politics teacher, and no doubt his students are listening to this. So let's try to humiliate him, shall we?
Here we go.
All right, Anthony, I'm gonna ask you a question and give you four choices.
Okay.
Who was the first former member of the House of Representatives to serve as president of the United States?
The first former member, somebody who had been a member of the House of Representatives and then became president.
That's right.
I think I know the answer to this one.
Who was the first former member of the U.S. House of Representatives?
What are the choices?
To serve as president. Is it A, James Madison? B, His Royal Highness Alexander Hamilton? C, Gerald Ford?
Could be.
Or D, Robert F. Kennedy?
Oh, my. Once again.
Who was the first former member of the U.S. House of Representatives to serve as president? James Madison, A. B. Alexander Hamilton, C. Gerald Ford, or D. Robert F. Kennedy?
Anthony?
Boy, that is a tough one, but I can eliminate a couple options right away. I know Alexander Hamilton was definitely not the president, and my students would know that as well. Kennedy was a senator. So he is out as well. I believe the answer is A, Madison.
You think it was A? Well, what was the other one?
Gerald Ford.
Gerald Ford. He was in the House of Representatives. He was actually minority leader.
Very much in the House of Representatives.
Very much in the House of Representatives. You don't think it was Gerald Ford?
I don't believe so. I believe Madison was the first.
Madison was indeed the first.
Ooh, man, you made me nervous there.
Sorry, Anthony. I was trying to get you off there. No, I think probably Ford is one of the best known people who ever, because he spent basically his whole career in the House before that series of events with Spiro Agnew and then Richard Nixon both resigning that elevated him rather strangely to the presidency. But no, Madison actually was. He very famously ran against, I believe it was James Monroe, wasn't it?
Mm, yeah. And he, you know, Madison was in the first Congress,
and the very first Congress where he drafted the Bill of Rights. So, yeah.
Kind of the first of the first.
He was the first of the first. Exactly right. So, well done, sir. Well done. You did not embarrass yourself in front of your students. So I think your students, as you play this, should all give you a great big round of applause. We'll give you a round of applause right now. Okay, students, join us with us. Okay. You have a very good teacher. And, of course, Anthony, that means you win both your pocket constitution from James Madison's Montpelier and your T-shirt, which I encourage you to wear at school with your class. Take a picture of yourself and send it to us, and we'll stick it on the Facebook page, okay?
Sounds great.
Okay, thanks, Anthony. We appreciate you. Oh, send me your size and your mailing address at ywc@montpelier.org, okay?
All right. Thank you very much, Stuart and Doug.
Okay. Yeah, thanks, Doug. Appreciate you.
Yeah, no problem. Just, you know, listeners should always remember, if James Madison is an option, choose it. It's the Constitution. I read it for the articles.
I'm asking you, what's the guy's name on first base?
Oh, no, what's on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who's on first?
One base at a time.
Don't mix up my...
I'm not mixing up anybody. Now, what's the guy's name on first base?
Now, what is on second?
I'm not asking you who's on second.
Who is on first?
I don't know.
He's on third. We're not talking.
It's Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and our subject this week, and in case you're just joining us now, you just heard Abbott and Costello with their famous sketch, Who's on First? And you might have guessed then that our subject today is baseball. And then you might wonder, why would a show about the Constitution be talking about baseball? Well, two reasons. Number one, because baseball is very constitutional, and we'll get to some of that in a little while. But also because my very good friend David O. Stewart has written a book, his latest historical novel, involving baseball. It's called The Babe Ruth Deception, and it's a really good read.
And I must say, you do a really wonderful job of capturing the play at that era, because as you point out, they were not at some big stadium. They were at the Polo Grounds, which, as you point out, had sort of irregular lines and wasn't really designed for baseball. And was really a kind of a cross between sandlot games and the professional parks that we see today.
Yeah, it was kind of weird. I mean, the outfield sloped down.
That'd make you had to get a home run.
Yeah, you needed to know the field to play it well. And, you know, all the major league parks, you know, they're famously, and even Yankee Stadium had a very short right field because they, you know, they didn't own the land to build a normal dimensions. That was true for many of the major league parks at the time.
It was a lot scrappier game back in those days.
Yeah, they weren't able to shake down the local governments quite so much and make them build big fancy stadiums and condemn land for them. They actually had to make it as a business.
What a concept. Okay, yeah. Now this, for the uninitiated, is, and I really enjoyed this tour through early 20th century baseball, but for the uninitiated, this is the background to your book. So into this historical background, you inject some familiar faces?
Yeah, I got my regular pair of heroes.
Right.
And it fit wonderfully because one is a former baseball player himself, a black fellow who's modeled after a real life figure who was the last black man to play professional baseball until Jackie Robinson broke in again. Major leagues had been integrated, but they drove the black players out in the 1880s.
That's a sad, sad tale. And you're right. There was a forced segregation. But who was the real character who your character was based on?
Moses Fleetwood Walker. And he was a man who understandably was angry about that sort of the rest of his life. Mm-hmm. Was known as a race man, and which at the time meant he stood up for his race.
That's an interesting term, though. A race man is a term that seems sort of pejorative. You know, he's the guy who's playing the race card. He's the guy who's so angry he can't get over the race issue. And yet today we would probably simply call someone like that a civil rights advocate.
Yeah, at the time, it took so much guts to stand up as a black person that calling someone a race man didn't mean he couldn't get over it. It meant he's really got guts.
Okay.
He's willing to take the hit. Mm-hmm. And so it was a very positive statement, although I'm sure there were a lot of white people who didn't think so. But within the African-American community, it was the highest compliment.
Okay, good. I'm glad you straightened me out on that one, because I had never really encountered that term, race man, before reading it in your books.
Yeah, it was a term that people would apply to themselves with pride.
Okay. So you based your character on a race man who had been a professional African-American ball player and who was angry about the treatment he'd received in the game. But your character's name is actually Speed Cook, isn't it?
Yeah, it's modeled a bit after Fleet Walker. And what was fun in this book was I was able to inject him into the Negro Leagues, which were, in fact, getting off the ground during this era. And, you know, one of the great things that this all mingles together is Babe Ruth was always accused of being black. It was one of the ways that they would that other players would try to get under his skin and needle him. He had thick lips and a flat nose, and so that was the angle that people took on him. And he would always barnstorm in the off season, go play pickup games against other teams and charge a lot of money, and he'd make the money instead of the owners making the money. And he always played against black teams. He had no problem with it. So he sort of comes to us as, you know, a bit of a big lug in many ways, not educated at all, not reflective at all, but, you know, he probably had a lot of the prejudices of the time, an unsophisticated guy, but he was not a man with a lot of prejudice.
Right. As you say, I mean, attitudes are different at different times, but I didn't detect, certainly from anything I've read about Babe Ruth, nor about your characterization of him, that he was someone who was motivated by any sort of strong streak of bigotry or hatred.
No. I mean, they had players at the time who were amazing in that regard, but, you know, Ruth.
Ty Cobb, for example.
He is the guy who comes to mind.
That great Detroit Tigers, who was apparently, he's from Georgia originally, and was just apparently not only very, very aggressive in the sense of being willing to spike people when he slid into second base or something of that sort, but was just a virulent, virulent, hateful racist, according to what I've learned.
Yeah, that is how he comes to us, although his worst moment for his reputation has always been when he beat up the crippled guy.
Oh, boy. Okay, I can't let that pass.
It's hard to get over that one.
Tell me about Ty Cobb, the great from Detroit. What did he do? He beat up a crippled guy?
Well, there was some guy heckling him from the stands. Cobb ran into the stands to slug him. And, you know, he got there and the guy couldn't stand up. He actually, you know, was disabled in some fashion.
Oh, good heavens.
And it didn't slow Cobb down at all. He beat the hell out of him.
Forgive me for laughing. It's been 100 years, so I guess I'll allow myself that. But okay, but Ruth was not that type. Ruth, as you say, was a big lug. Ruth had enormous talent. Ruth was now playing for the New York Yankees. He's now a big power hitter. Ruth, of course, is a real character who appears in your book, and that's more or less the characterization of him. So how do you bring him together with Speed Cook of the so-called Negro Leagues of that era?
Well, you know, Speed wants him to play against his team in the offseason, so that's one hook. But what was a remarkable connection, and one of the reasons I like writing these novels is finding these connections. Remarkable connection was the gamblers who fixed the Black Sox scandal, who created the Black Sox scandal, who bribed the players in the 1919 World Series, included a guy who actually bankrolled a movie that Babe Ruth made during the 1920 season. He's this world featherweight champion, former champion named Abe Attell, and he was a number two guy to Arnold Rothstein, who's a sort of famous hoodlum who did rig the series. And he put up $50,000 for the Babe's movie. So suddenly you've got the Babe hanging out with the hoods. And it's...
And all that happened in real life.
That happened.
Yeah, that happened in real life. And again, that's what I find so compelling about your books is how you're able to take real life events and weave them into this story. And I had not been aware that there had been this nexus between Arnold Rothstein, who of course has been immortalized in a number of fictionalized accounts from The Godfather to Boardwalk Empire.
Yes.
Yeah, I mean he's been a figure who's been exemplified throughout this time, has been fictionalized, but you wove it into your own story, didn't you?
Yeah, and you know, anytime you can sort of ring one of those bells, it's a lot of fun. And he was properly there. So my other lead character is a doctor, and his wife is a theatrical person. So I was able to make her one of the producers who had to deal with this guy. So I was able to get the whole family together.
Indeed, you got most of them together in your very first scene, which was great too, because your very first scene, so I'm not giving much away here, is when you have Ruth with Jamie, the doctor's wife, in one of Ruth's cars. And I say one of them because he wrecked them on a regular basis. And that's exactly how your book starts. He wrecks his car.
Yeah, he was a it's a fascinating phenomenon. He was a truly terrible driver, but he walked away from a number of wrecks, so it wasn't hard to imagine one. When he wasn't wrecking the cars, he was getting a speeding ticket or talking his way out of one. He was an extremely dangerous man to take a ride with.
But he was so prominent, at least according to your account, that when he would get a ticket or even roll his car over and dump people onto the ground, because, of course, this is long before seatbelts are in cars, people would recognize him and the problems would simply all go away.
Pretty much. It was a time when being a celebrity was pretty good.
Yeah, Babe Ruth seemed to enjoy his celebrity status. In fact, you also capture another legend of his is that he didn't take any care of himself at all. He loved to gorge himself on beer and other drinks and hot dogs and all sorts of things that these days we would advise him to stay away from, but he was a man of enormous appetites.
enormous appetites, not all food. And
right.
He was very enthusiastic about female company. And, you know, I think it was because he grew up in the orphanage, which was not a very lush experience. He couldn't get enough of anything. He's the guy who always wanted more.
Indeed he did. So he shows up. It's 1920. Your characters are starting to come together. Speed Cook wants the Babe to play some of his Negro League teams. So what happens next?
Well, they get into a couple of things happen. Of course, we have a terrorist incident, the first terrorist bombing in New York mm-hmm. in 1920, which did happen.
Mm-hmm.
And then, which brings together some of the characters. It happened down on Wall Street. And then...
Right outside the Morgan Bank, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And then we have a problem trying to figure out how the Babe is going to disentangle himself from Arnold Rothstein and the bad guys. Mm-hmm. So that becomes one of the principal parts of the story is how is he going to get out from under them.
It's your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and today I'm speaking with author David O. Stewart, a constitutional lawyer and a historian who's now written a book about that most constitutional of sports, baseball.
Football has the 2-minute warning.
Baseball has no time limit. We don't know when it's going to end. We might have extra innings.
After the break, we'll have our Madison Minute, and then we'll finish our discussion with David, and then we'll talk a little bit about the special legal status of the national pastime. Stay tuned.
Wondered what it would be like to meet James Madison? Well, here's an account from a visitor to Montpelier. He is quite a short, thin man with his head bald except on the back where his hair hangs down to his collar and over his ears, nicely powdered. He has gray but bright eyes and small features and seems very hale and hearty. The expression of his face is full of good humor. He was dressed in black, with breeches and old-fashioned top boots which he afterwards took off and sat the evening in his white stockings. But the next day he had black silk on and looked very nice. I talked with, or rather listened to, Mr. Madison almost exclusively while I remained. We sat up pretty late. His favorite topic appeared to be the early constitutional history of this country, the state of the Confederacy originally, the points involved in the Constitution, the errors relative to many facts which he pointed out. The next morning I was down some time before the ladies, but found him already reading in the parlor. With your Madison Minute, I'm Jen Patia Howell.
How did I get on third base?
You mentioned his name.
I mentioned his name?
Yes.
I don't know anybody's name on the team. How could I mention a guy's name?
You did. You just mentioned it.
All right. What's the guy's name on third base?
No, what's on second?
Who's on second?
Who's on first?
I don't know.
He's on first.
See what I mean? I didn't even mention a guy's name on third base.
Yes, you did.
All right, then. Who's playing third base?
No, who's on first?
I'm not asking you what's on first.
What's on second?
Who's on second?
Who's on first?
I don't know. He's third base.
You're listening to your Weekly Constitutional. I'm Stuart Harris, and I'm interviewing author David O. Stewart, who's written a number of historical novels. They all have the word deception in their title. The first one was called The Lincoln Deception. The second one was called The Wilson Deception. We actually interviewed David about that one. And the current one is called The Babe Ruth Deception. And all of them have a constitutional theme, even this last one, because as we've been discussing, baseball is the most constitutional of sports. All three of David's books involve the same lead characters. Their names are Jamie and Speed Cook.
And Speed has a son who...
Speed has a son who we have known from the last book. He was a soldier in World War I, and he's back. And like many of the discharged black veterans, having a terrible time finding his way in the world. Mm-hmm. Because opportunities are so few for young black males. Mm-hmm. That's sort of a constant in our life, in our world. Mm-hmm. And So he turns to bootlegging because the money's good.
Indeed he does, and there's a romantic entanglement between him and Jamie's daughter, who happens to be of a different persuasion. So there's an issue of interracial romance as well.
Yeah, that was a chance. I took a few chances here. Mm-hmm. That was a chance I wanted to take there. It seemed to me that, you know, of course that happened back then. Mm-hmm. But the taboo was really strong. And the these days I suspect there are communities in which it's not comfortable to be in an interracial pair. But then it was dangerous.
Right.
How they would try to negotiate that seemed to me worthy of some attention.
Well, we're not going to talk too much more about the plot because I think we've given people just enough to whet their appetite. But clearly, your plot touches upon major events, minor events even, that have happened during that era. And it also paints a very good picture of what life was like, especially around New York City during that era. How do you research a book like this?
You know, the internet's a wonderful thing.
It is indeed.
You can learn a lot. And what I love is you can get photographs. I could get recordings of the Babe's voice, him speaking. I have this movie. There's an hour-long movie that he made in 1920, exactly the time I want to portray what he looked like. Mm-hmm. So that's all good. I do make an effort to read novels from the era. It gives me a window into the language people were using, the thought, and the things they were thinking about, and sort of their attitudes. I can't point to any single thing that flows directly from that, but I just feel like it helps me feel what the time was like. It's obviously an act of imagination to come up with that, but I find engaging with some other person's imagination from that era helps me do that.
That's really very interesting. Back in days of yore, if you wanted to see what the Colosseum in Rome looked like, really see it, you basically had to travel to Rome. And writers would do that. They would take trips and they would soak up the atmosphere. As you've pointed out, these days you might be able to write a very convincing account of somebody in the Colosseum simply by looking at pictures and reading up on it and all the rest of it. But I had not really thought about reading fiction from that particular era in order to get a sense for the way people spoke.
Yeah, it's very much for the diction, how they put words together. And it's a window into their minds.
Mm-hmm.
And I like, you know, I've done a bunch of straight history back in the from the founding era, the late 1700s and early 1800s. And I think the language of the way people wrote then really does give insight into the way they thought. When you get up to the 1920, the language has changed a great deal. I also love just picking up the slang.
Sure.
There was one term I used, which I'm pretty sure very few people will get, but I figured what the heck, which was parlor snake.
Yeah, I don't know what that means. I saw that, but I don't know what it meant.
Well, I got it from an F. Scott Fitzgerald book and then was able to determine that other people, yeah, it was used. It was in general use. Mm-hmm. It meant sort of a Lothario, no good Nick, who was hanging around in hotel lobbies and parlors, just sort of, you know, drinking and trying to pick up women and generally being unproductive.
A drugstore cowboy.
Yeah, but maybe at a little bit higher level.
Okay.
A higher income level.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
That's all I meant.
The sort of guy you didn't want your daughter to meet.
You would not like that. So, you know, I write books, so I care a lot about language. And it was fun to – it's always fun to explore how people express themselves differently. You see, with this era, the one good thing was – and I'm betraying my age here, but – if I knew a phrase because my mother used to use it, I figured I was okay. So
that's really true. She was of that generation.
Well, just barely, uh-huh. And not even quite. But you know, slang has a long echo, and she used a lot of colorful terms. And so, if I'd heard it from her, I figured we were okay.
That's fantastic. All right, tremendous. And I'm guessing also one last thing on the research. You probably also read sports columns or sports news articles from that era.
I read some. There is a sort of terminal floweriness to the writing at the time. Mm-hmm. You know, you're not able to call Babe Ruth Babe Ruth. You have to call him the Sultan of SWAT, the King of Home Runs, the Bambino, and it's just overpowering. So I didn't have much tolerance for that. I spent an ungodly amount of time reading the box scores. Mm-hmm. they're all available online.
Sure.
And you can tell a lot from a box score. I've been a baseball fan a long time. And it was interesting for me to try to puzzle out what really went on during each game. And mm-hmm. I spent a lot of time on the 1921 series. I think it was a terribly important series and was fascinating. So I did study that a lot.
Well, did I overstate it when I said earlier that baseball really does have a place, a special place as Americana? I mean, this is, after all, a show about American politics, American constitutional politics. And maybe I was stretching a bit too far, but there's a part of me that whenever I think of baseball, it makes me feel strangely patriotic. And I don't know if I've overstated it. I think that really is part of the national psyche. Even today. Well,
yeah, very much. You know, it's been supplanted some from when I was a kid, mm-hmm. when it really was the game. You know, we now, you know, football rivals it. You know, half the players now are from other countries, mm-hmm. and they're wonderful players. So it's evolved as it has to. But, you know, it's not quite the time in the – during World War II and all the movies, whenever you try to tell if he was a German spy, you just ask him, you know, how did the St. Louis Browns do yesterday? And uh-huh. if, right. you know, if he said they won, you knew he was a spy.
Right.
but
that was a dig.
Yeah. But, you know, it's still a wonderful sport. And what I find with my own kids, too, as they get older, they come to it. It's a game that sort of has some emotional and intellectual tug, which is, I think, part of why it's survived. You know, it's endured so long and is really at the heart of a lot of our sort of national self-image.
Okay. Well, then I didn't overstate it. And so this does have relevance to the United States Constitution. Anyway, what is anything you want to add about your book or about your research methods?
Oh, no. This has been wonderful. I do think it's a fun read. This is not meant to be instructive. This is meant to sort of put you in a time and place and get you to sort of understand what was going on back then.
Okay. The Babe Ruth Deception by David O. Stewart is available now at your friendly neighborhood bookstore and also, I'm sure, online. And
absolutely.
You know what you need to do? You need to put an audiobook out as well.
We're working on that.
Yeah.
The first two in the series are in audiobooks, and we're working on getting this one too.
Okay. Well, David Stewart, thank you so much for telling us about this wonderful bit of Americana. We appreciate your time.
Thanks so much.
All right, now who's up first?
Right.
Okay. No. All right, you got a first base.
Yes.
When you pay off the first base from every month, who gets the money?
Every dollar of it. Every dollar of it.
Who gets it?
He does. Sometimes his wife comes down and collects it.
Whose wife?
Yes. Why not, Lou? He's earned it.
Who did?
Yes.
Look, will you pay off the first base from every month? You get a receipt from the guy?
Sure.
How does he sign his name?
Who?
The guy you give the money to.
Who?
The guy you give the money to.
Well, that's how he signs it.
That's how who signs it?
Yes.
Well, go ahead, tell me.
That's it.
Who? Look, you go to the first base.
Yes.
And you say to him, here's your money, sign the receipt. How does he sign his name?
Who?
The guy you give the money to. That's
how. Okay, Wayne, you've been very, very patient with me. I've been telling you for weeks that I had a baseball episode I wanted to do, and you kept demanding, what does baseball have to do with the Constitution? Well, I think we've already established with our interview with David Stewart and with the wonderful excerpts that you've been playing for us from various baseball songs and other things, and those are all to your credit, Wayne, that the baseball is special. Baseball has a special status in American society. And it's not just a societal thing. It's not just a matter of the national psyche. It's a matter of the law. And in fact, there have been, count them, three Supreme Court cases, three United States Supreme Court cases where the special status of baseball has been first decided and then repeatedly upheld. So, Wayne, this is for you.
Okay, in my lifetime, I remember when free agency came about because of Curt Flood, and that was in 1970. But what kind of constitutional relevance did baseball have before that?
Well, you've hit the last of the three cases, so let me take them in order. Let's go back in time much earlier than 1970. Let's go back to the 1920s, actually. And the very first relevant case here is Federal Baseball Club versus National League. Now, baseball had been around since the 1860s. Teams had been playing each other, of course, since the very beginning. Eventually, they started forming leagues. You had the formation of the National League, then the American League. Many people don't realize there was a third league, at least three leagues. It was called the Federal League, and it was set up as a competitor to these two.
Right. When you read the Ring Lardner stories, he talks about jumping to the Federal League sometimes.
Exactly right. Well, people did jump back and forth between the Federal League and the other leagues. But the Federal League ultimately folded, and it folded in 1915. When the other leagues, the American League and the National League, started absorbing some but not all of those teams. And the teams that were left behind, notably the Federal Baseball Club, thought that the way that Major League Baseball was acting was in violation of something called the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Which it would seem to be, it was.
Well, it seems that way to a lot of people. And if you simply look at baseball as a business, it's very clear that it crosses state lines. It's very clear that there's business being transacted. I mean, baseball certainly is big money today, but it was money all along. And generally speaking, when the government gets into regulating commerce, it's regulating interstate commerce. In fact, it specifically has what's commonly called the interstate commerce power in Article 1, Section 8. And the Sherman Antitrust Act, which had been enacted just a few years earlier in the late 19th century, was specifically designed to prevent, broadly speaking, what's called monopolistic behavior. Well, when you have supposedly competing groups, competing ball clubs, competing businesses joining together, that looks like a monopoly, or what was then called a trust. But when the Federal Baseball Club went to court, much to, I'm sure, its disappointment and perhaps its surprise, the great Justice Oliver Wendell Holmes held just the opposite. In fact, this is what he said. The business is giving exhibitions of baseball, which are purely state affairs. It is true that in order to attain for these exhibitions the great popularity that they have achieved, competitions must be arranged between clubs from different cities and states. But the fact that in order to give the exhibitions, the leagues must induce free persons to cross state lines and must arrange and pay for their doing so is not enough to change the character of the business. If that seems odd to you, Wayne.
Seems very odd.
If that seems odd to you, it's a symptom of the times. You see, back in the early 1920s, we were in what's commonly called the Lochner era. And this was a time when the court was very narrowly interpreting what interstate commerce means. This is very, very important in constitutional history. Their interpretation of commerce was so narrow that, for example, if the government tried to regulate a steel company that sold steel all over the world, they would just look at one factory and they would say, well, no, this one factory where the federal government's trying to regulate it is in one state, and therefore it's not interstate commerce. So it was a whole era in which the definition of commerce was so narrow as to almost defy logic.
Okay, so that's the first time the Supreme Court made a ruling regarding baseball. What was the second?
The second one was a 1953 case called Toulson versus New York Yankees. And this was a case that was challenging the infamous reserve clause of baseball contracts, in which essentially allowed baseball teams to trade players even against their will, and it effectively prevented what we now call free agency, where, you know, the baseball players get to choose where they're going to go when their contracts are up.
So when you signed with a team, that team owned you and you played for that team unless that team decided to trade you or sell you. You didn't have any say-so about it.
Exactly right. Well, and the court basically upheld all of this. The court basically said that this is, we're really, there's a lot of constitutional stuff going on here, but what we're interpreting is the Sherman Antitrust Act, and Congress has known for years, since 1924, that we have a narrow interpretation of that act, and if Congress had wanted to change it, it could go ahead and change it. So this is really deferring to Congress, basically saying since they haven't changed it, Congress mustn't like what's going on. Well, free agency, the concept didn't die. And just a few years later, in the early 1970s, we have the case of Flood versus Kuhn, which is the one that you were mentioning, where the great baseball player Curt Flood also challenged the reserve clause.
So did he have the Congress or the Supreme Court to thank for that?
Well, ultimately, as we all know, free agency exists, but he didn't get it from the court. And in fact, in what's really become sort of an infamous decision, Flood versus Kuhn, which was 1972, the Supreme Court again reaffirmed the earlier case from 1924 and, of course, the 1953 case Toulson, and said, again, if Congress wants to change this, Congress can change this law, but we are not going to change it because of a concept called stare decisis, which simply means in Latin, it's a Latin term, which means in English, let it be. They don't want to disturb earlier holdings, even if they're wrong. And the court pretty much acknowledged that these decisions made no sense, that baseball was no different from football, but football was subject to these laws, etc. We're not going to change it simply because people have grown accustomed to it and people have relied upon it for so many years. And so what actually happened was after that case was decided that way, after Curt Flood lost his case, then the National Labor Relations Board reinterpreted the National Labor Relations Act and effectively ended the reserve clause and started the era of free agency,
which allowed baseball players to sell their services to the highest bidder, and which in turn caused baseball ticket prices to go sky high.
Indeed, they did. And as much as I'd like to see people earning whatever the market will bear, and I always am in favor of people earning money for their time, it means that you and I have to pay very high prices. In fact, last time I went to a major league game, I was stunned by how much I had to pay.
It does cost quite a bit, but here's a plug for the Appalachian League and the Johnson City Cardinals.
And the Knoxville Smokies.
The Knoxville Smokies, but then we always have our favorite team from back home.
The Detroit Tigers.
You got it.
Go get 'em, Tiger. Rawr.
We're all behind our baseball team. Go get 'em, Tiger.
World Series bound and picking up steam.
Go get 'em, Tiger.
There'll be joy in Tiger Town. We'll sing you songs when the Bengals bring the pennant home where it belongs.
We're all behind our
straight up and deep on Fielder. He is the DH today. Swing, there's a drive to left. That one is long gone.
We're all behind our baseball team.
Go get them.
Detroit Tigers.
Go get them, Tigers.
And that's our show. Thanks so very much to author David O. Stewart, my good buddy, who has written that marvelous book, The Babe Ruth Deception. You should run out and buy 15 copies of it, because it, even if you're not a baseball fan, even if you're just an American, you will enjoy the way it portrays that early 20th century baseball spirit. It's just really an effective and a vivid portrait of that that era, which is so essential to our history and even our constitutional history. Our executive producer, who also joined me today on the show, is Wayne Winkler. Our scheduler is Carol Hutchinson. Our distribution engineer is Chad Barrett. Our Madison Minute is by the incomparable Jen Patia Howell from the Robert H. Smith Center for the Constitution at James Madison's historic home, Montpelier. Our music is by the fifes and drums of Colonial Williamsburg. My name is Stuart Harris. And remember, you are a part of the American experiment, so go out and see a ball game.